Ladies and gentlemen, it's an enormous privilege and pleasure to be able to welcome you to the 28th Eric Symes Abbott Memorial Lecture, both on behalf of the Dean and Chapter and on behalf of the trustees of the Memorial Fund. Eric Abbott was Dean of King's College London from 1945 to 1955, and then became Warden of Keble College, Oxford, and then Dean of Westminster from 1959 till 1974. He was appointed a Knight Commander of the Royal Victorian Order in 1966, and he died in 1983. His ashes are buried just here, and on his grave it says, Pastor Pastorum, a pastor of the pastors, a shepherd of the shepherds. And his work with ordinands, amongst others, and clergy throughout his life was remarkable. The memorial lecture was founded in the year of his death in 1983 by the Dean of King's at the time, Richard Harris, who's now again a member of the committee, Lord Harris of Pentregarth, with the Warden of Keble, Sir Jonathan Phillips, and the Dean of King's and the Dean of Westminster, John Robson as well, who's an old friend of Eric Abbott and remains a member of the committee. This is the 28th lecture in a series, and there are copies of a number of the lectures still available, and there'll be copies of this lecture available afterwards. This time, for the first time, there'll be a chance to respond to the lecture by asking questions, and there'll be people moving amongst you with movable microphones, and there'll be a chance, therefore, for a few minutes after the lecture to ask questions or indeed to respond. We're delighted that Professor Dame Averil Cameron is giving this year's lecture. She was, during her time as Warden of Keble and therefore a successor of Eric Abbott, a member of the committee, and the lecture is given a second time at Keble College, Oxford, and will be there tomorrow evening at 5:30. If any of you have a passion to hear it again, just get yourself down the A40. She brings together King's College London and Keble in her own person, having been Professor of Ancient History and then of Late Antiquity and Byzantine History at King's College London before moving to become Warden of Keble in 1994, where she was until 2010. And she was also, during much of that time, Professor of Late Antiquity and Byzantine History. Amongst other things, she chaired also the Cathedral's Fabric Commission for England, and she also chaired a review of the Royal Peculiars, only two of them, us and St. George's Chapel, Windsor. She was appointed Dame Commander of the Order of the British Empire in 2006. And her subject is one of great importance to us here at Westminster Abbey, as bringing together as we do, as we conceive ourselves, faith at the heart of the nation, church and state together. So I'm looking forward very much to hearing the lecture, and we're all looking forward to welcoming Dame Averil to the podium. Thank you very much.
It's wonderful to be invited to give this lecture because I was, as Warden of Keble, I was a trustee of the Memorial Fund for 16 years, and the main function of that meeting that we had every year, in fact, I'm sure it happened this afternoon, was to choose the lecturers. And then when I was invited, I was very, very touched. And Eric Abbott, as the Dean reminded us, was at, first of all, at King's College London. He was Warden of Keble, but he was rather soon translated to be Dean of Westminster. But he's still remembered at Keble by some of the old members and alumni of the college. And I never met him, but he evidently had a tremendous personal effect on many of the people who did meet him. And so Pastor Pastorum is a very appropriate inscription. So my title is Constantine's Vision and the Church Today, from the Battle of the Milvian Bridge AD 312 to the 21st century. Well, I think it's more about Constantine than all those centuries. 1700 years ago this year, the Emperor Constantine issued the Edict of Milan, which ended the persecution of Christians in the Roman Empire and declared religious toleration. 1701 years ago, at the end of October, AD 312, when he was already over 40, he had seen a vision of the cross in the sky, won a great battle, fought on and around one of the bridges over the River Tiber in Rome, the Milvian Bridge, and was converted to Christianity, which he went on to make the official religion of the Roman Empire. Thereby, Constantine set in motion the Christianization of Europe and made the Christian Church what it is today. This is what you will read in many books, and it's what many people believe. The trouble is, every separate element is open to question, if not actually wrong. For instance, the Edict of Milan, so-called, was not an edict, an imperial law. It was a letter. It was not issued by Constantine. It was issued by his co-emperor and his rival, Licinius. And persecution of Christians had already ended 2 years before. How far the so-called edict was actually about religious toleration in the modern sense, I will come back to. As for Constantine's vision, many scholars now believe, I will come back to this too, that what he saw in the sky was the meteorological phenomenon known as a solar halo. And even those who are prepared to admit that he may have had a religious experience doubt that this was the point at which he converted to Christianity. He'd seen other visions already, including a vision of the sun god, Apollo. Finally, he may have set Christianity on the path towards becoming a state religion, but that only happened much later, and the idea that he made it the official religion of the empire is a very modern idea. He wouldn't have understood it. Constantine remains an enigma. These two anniversaries, and that of his accession to the throne in 306, have been receiving a huge amount of attention. There have been major exhibitions in York, where Constantine was first proclaimed emperor in Britain, at Trier, his western capital in Germany, Ravenna in Rome, and, of course, in Milan, which is currently mounting an exhibition with the title The Edict of Milan and the Age of Toleration. Sounds wonderful. A play about Constantine has been put on this year to great fanfare in Belgrade, commemorating the fact that he was actually born at Niš in modern Serbia. A day's conference on Constantine was held recently at the British Museum, and an Italian encyclopedia devoted to him will soon be published, many, many hundreds of pages. A raft of new books depict him in wildly different ways, according to the personal approach of each author. And finally, the last speaker at the British Museum event, a distinguished historian of Roman art, who is now ordained in the Church of England, forcefully declared that the reign of Constantine had been a tragedy. He meant a tragedy for the church. What is this all about? I want to ask why there seem to be so many problems and disagreements surrounding Constantine, and then to bring out some of the tensions and ambiguities that surrounded him, as well as the pressures that he was put under. I will argue that they have strong resonances with our own experiences and those of church leaders, governments, and anyone in authority today. But history is often a matter of unexpected results. Constantine could not foresee the future. What we read about him in the works of contemporary authors is not what he himself necessarily intended or realized. And yet, without him, what kind of church would there be today? And would it be better than what we now have, as my colleague at the British Museum evidently believes? Let's listen to some of Constantine's own words from a homily he apparently delivered in Latin on Good Friday, perhaps in modern Sofia in Bulgaria, another imperial centre. This speech, it's preserved in Greek, but he would have given it in Latin. It would have taken about 2 hours to deliver, and that was nothing for a speech at the time. They liked very long speeches. The very recent persecution of Christians is much in his mind. So are the pagan gods, with their oracles and temples. For him, though, the world can only be explained by belief in the providence and goodness of God. Plato, he says, had some understanding of this, though he still believed in many gods. But Christ the Saviour has shown the truth by his life, his miracles, and his teaching. This is an emperor speaking. He knows the standard arguments against Christianity and how to address them, how to argue against them. He refers to the prophets Daniel and Isaiah and to the story of Moses. He quotes the oracle of the Sibyl, interprets the child foretold in Virgil's fourth eclogue as a reference to Christ, and ascribes his own victory over his rivals, the persecutors, to the inspiration and help of God. Presentation is crucial to establishing authority. In 2013, we have seen a new archbishop introducing African dancers into Canterbury Cathedral, a new pope refusing to wear the ermine or live in the papal apartments. Constantine chose to speak in the language of Christian apologetic. Delivered by a Roman emperor, this speech was sensational. Some scholars believe it was given very soon after the Edict of Milan. But could Constantine really have absorbed so quickly the complex arguments that Christians had built up over three centuries against paganism? It may have been a bit later, but not too much later. In fact, Constantine had a taste for preaching. Later in his reign, we are told that he used to preach regularly to the court on Fridays, to the embarrassment of the courtiers and the officials who shuffled their feet and pretended it wasn't really happening. The language of Roman law always tended to be moralizing, but he outdid his predecessors here as well. After he'd defeated Licinius in 324 and become the sole emperor of the Roman world, because there had been several emperors at the same time when he first came to the throne. So after he became the sole emperor of the entire Roman world, east and west, he issued two pieces of legislation in the form of letters sent out in both Latin and Greek to Roman officials in every province. The first ordered the restitution of property to Christians dispossessed during the persecutions. But it also contained a lengthy statement of Constantine's Christian beliefs. He says, "Their truth has long been obvious, but," and I quote, "now they have been even more clearly demonstrated by more manifest deeds and more brilliant achievements, both the absurdity of doubt and the magnitude of the power of the great God." He has all the enthusiasm of a convert, but his language is nothing if not turgid. But he goes on and asks, "Who is likely to meet with any good if he neither acknowledges the God who is the source of good things, nor is willing to worship him properly. The other law harangued his subjects about the wickedness of paganism and the benefits of conversion to Christianity, and contains lengthy thanks to God for demonstrating the truth, even though, at the end, he admits that it wasn't yet possible to prohibit paganism already. Altogether, I'm sorry. The emperor was no slouch in presentation. He's recently been memorably seen as a populist autocrat. Populist is the key word. But Constantine also believed that he had a duty imposed on him by God to establish right worship in the empire. In the year after the Edict of Milan, and I have sort of inverted commas around the quote marks around the Edict of Milan, in the year after the Edict of Milan, he wrote to the Roman governor in North Africa, this time about quarrels between Christians. He found out that they were quarreling between themselves about who should be Bishop of Carthage. And he'd already tried to settle this by calling a meeting in Rome, and this time he invited the parties to come to a church council at Arles. All of these were absolutely novel for someone in his position. His reason, though, is telling, because in a letter he says, God will only look well on his reign. His reason is very personal. God will only look well on his reign, quote, if all men worship the most holy God by the due rites of the Catholic religion in harmonious and brotherly observance. So he sees it as laid upon him to establish correct worship throughout the empire if he can, or at least as far as he can. And he seems to believe that he will suffer, God will punish him in some way if he doesn't try his best. Constantine was certainly very interested in the church. After all, he summoned the Council of Nicaea, the first ecumenical council, whose agreed statement, and those who refused to sign it were sent into exile, no messing about, forms the basis of the creed we still use today. But against every example like these of his support for Christianity, his engagement with Christianity, one can find a different argument suggesting caution and ambivalence. For years, he kept the dedication to the sun god on his coins. The inscription still to be seen on the Arch of Constantine in Rome next to the Colosseum is carefully ambiguous. Come back to that. Pagan temples were only closed in one or two exemplary cases. He had a statue of himself put up on a huge column in the new city of Constantinople, the city of Constantine, Istanbul, looking suspiciously like the sun god. He was only baptized when he was dying, and even then, he was hailed as a god when he died. Was this because he was not fully committed to Christianity? Lots of people have thought that. Or perhaps because he was a canny politician in a world where Christians formed a very small minority of the population. I think less than 10%. I think that may be generous, actually. We can look at it, though, in a different way. An Israeli scholar writing of this period has referred to a media revolution, and I think he's got something. Constantine, somehow, had picked up a lot of the current terminology about Christianity versus paganism. He knew his argumentation. He probably got that from the Latin Christian writer Lactantius, who was teaching in Nicomedia when he was growing up. But his real publicist was someone different. He was the Bishop Eusebius of Caesarea in Palestine, on the coast of modern Israel, who was also the first historian of the church since the time of Christ. When Constantine won his victory at the Milvian Bridge in Rome in AD 312, Eusebius added a section. He'd already more or less finished his church history. He added a section to the end, because this was extraordinary and amazing, comparing Constantine and his troops to the Israelites crossing the Red Sea. Many years later, Eusebius wrote a life of Constantine, which went much further. Like Moses, Constantine had led his people from the tyranny of the persecutors of the Christians. As God's servant, like Moses, he had given them the true law from God. In his last campaign, described by Eusebius in this biography — it's not really a biography, but it's called The Life of Constantine — he tells us Constantine built a tent in which he prayed on the battlefield. I quote, "Like the ancient prophet of God," that's Moses, "who, so the divine oracles assure us," that's the Old Testament, "pitched his tent outside the encampment." Eusebius's whole version also of Constantine's vision in 312 is patterned on the story of Moses and the burning bush. And Constantine's standard, his imperial standard, known as the Labarum, is like the Ark of the Covenant in the book of Exodus. When Eusebius wrote his life, he also took the opportunity to edit his earlier version. Now we read that Constantine's former ally, Licinius, the probable author of the Edict of Milan, is cast in the role of a persecutor. He has become the foil for Constantine, the new Moses. And that, of course, is justification for the fact that Constantine made war on him and eliminated him, and so became sole emperor. After all, he was a real realist and a real emperor. Actually, Eusebius, the bishop, was not very close to Constantine. He'd only met him once or twice. At the Council of Nicaea, he was bowled over. As the emperor entered the hall where all the bishops were sitting waiting, he looked to Eusebius, and I quote again, "like a heavenly angel of God, his bright mantle shedding luster like beams of light, shining with the fiery radiance of a purple robe and decorated with the dazzling brilliance of gold and precious stones." After the council, Constantine put on a banquet for the bishops, and Eusebius thought it was like being in God's kingdom. It was like the kingdom of heaven. He found it almost incredible that Christian clergy could enter the palace and not be afraid of the guards with their drawn swords. That tells you what life was really like. Constantine's armed guards were on a different level from the Queen's Yeomen of the Guard in Buckingham Palace. Eusebius was a bishop, and when he wrote these works, he was expressing his own agendas. He was not putting forward official propaganda from the imperial side. At least I don't think so. He describes the spectacle, the sight of the emperor in all his glory at the Council of Nicaea, but not the arguments. That would have been too awkward, because he himself had gone to the Council of Nicaea under a cloud for having the wrong doctrinal beliefs. It didn't take much time for the sight of the emperor to suggest to him the advantages of towing the imperial line. He was not the only bishop who saw the enormous opportunity presented to the church in having an emperor who was overtly Christian. The American scholar Harold Drake has argued that it was Christian bishops like Eusebius who pushed Constantine towards more clearly Christian policies. I'm not sure about that. But anyway, it was certainly not only Eusebius who tried to influence the emperor. Others had their own agendas too. and the influences that Constantine encountered when he first started to involve himself in matters of the church, he didn't quite know what he was getting into, are worth looking at a little more. Constantine's father, Constantius, ruled in the West, and Constantine was with him when he died in York in AD 306, and that's when Constantine was proclaimed emperor by the army. The bishop, Eusebius, does his level best to suggest that Constantius, Constantine's father, was also a Christian. In fact, he wasn't, as far as we know, and he paints an affecting picture of a deathbed scene with all his family around him. Constantius's court, he says, was just like a church. But later in the same work, The Life of Constantine, he lets slip that Constantine had to turn to some clergy to instruct him as to who his father's God really was. These clergy, whoever they were, did a good job. As soon as he won his victory in 312, Constantine gave special tax concessions to clergy and instructed provincial governors to use state funds to help bishops travel to church councils. He gave bishops legal powers, and he was extremely deferential to them, not chairing church councils himself and saying that the bishops, not he, are God's representatives, and he would defer to them. We surely see the bishops in action, consolidating their position with the emperor. His stance as a listening, deferential, respectful ruler was a careful balancing act, and it didn't stop him from exiling people if they crossed him, as I said. After the Council of Nicaea, he changed his mind. He brought back those who'd been exiled after that council, and he was himself baptized by an anti-Nicene bishop. He now sent three pro-Nicene bishops into exile, and one of them was St. Athanasius, whose feast it is today, the great theologian Athanasius. Rulers and bishops, emperors and popes have clashed, coexisted, and attempted to put pressure on each other ever since. Let's go back to Constantine's vision. Already in 313, that's the time of the so-called Edict of Milan, just after the victory, an imperial orator, not a Christian, knew, or thought he knew, that a great victory had taken place under divine guidance. 8 years later, another imperial orator had worked up the story much more. Now we read, and people heard in official speeches, that Constantine had been helped on the battlefield by heavenly armies, not Christian, led by his father Constantius. So heavenly troops had ridden from down and helped him on the battlefield. Put up 3 years after the battle, the Arch of Constantine, as I mentioned earlier, has an inscription on it, which merely refers to divine inspiration, leaving carefully vague the identity of the divinity. As for Christian versions of the battle, the Latin writer Lactantius claims that Christ appeared to Constantine in a dream and told him to paint a sign on his shields, the shields of the soldiers. Perhaps, though this is not certain from the text, the sign of the Chiro, the first two letters in Greek of Christ. But when Eusebius composed his life of Constantine many years later, he included the most famous and the most circumstantial description of what Constantine saw in 312. Now, for the first time, we are told that what the emperor saw was a cross of light in the sky, with the words, "In this conquer." And I'm sure you're familiar with many, many depictions of that. And I'm going to quote the passage. "About the time of the midday sun, when day was just turning, He said he saw with his own eyes, up in the sky and resting over the sun, a cross-shaped trophy formed from light, and a text attached to it which said, "By this conquer." Amazement at the spectacle seized both him and the whole company of soldiers which was then accompanying him on a campaign he was conducting somewhere, and who all witnessed the miracle. Don't forget that a pagan orator had already claimed in a speech at the court in 310, before that victory, that Constantine had seen a vision of the sun god on another campaign. And there are some awkward features about Eusebius's version as well. He's vague, to say the least, about where the vision took place. He says, somewhere. It's not very good. While Constantine was on campaign, he doesn't say it was on the night before the battle, as Lactantius does. And having described the making of the great standard, the Labarum, in improbable detail, and claimed that Constantine always took it into battle, he actually then says that, however, was somewhat later. Whereas at the time, when he saw whatever he saw in the sky, Constantine was stunned. Too stunned, I think, to make a jeweled imperial standard and take it into battle a few days later. Eusebius goes further to improve his story. He beefs it up by claiming that he'd heard it from the emperor himself, which is perhaps not very probable given what we know about their lack of communication. Modern rationalist historians have tried to bring all these accounts together. They suggest, and this is a rather popular idea at the moment, they suggest that there was only one vision, happened in 310, not in 312 in Rome, and that it can be explained as an example of meteorological phenomena, the solar halo. And that what happened was that, thinking it over in later years, Constantine had explained to himself his victory at the Milvian Bridge in Rome by reinterpreting that vision or that sign, that whatever it was, as a sign from the Christian God. I think this is the wrong approach. It's surely unnecessary. There were plenty of visions. This was an age when visions and dreams were common to all religious groups, especially just before battles. Plenty of emperors before Constantine, not Christian ones, had had visions before battles. So I think it's just the wrong way of going about it. And I'm tempted to say we don't know what Constantine saw, but that's another story. But was Eusebius making it up? The great Edward Gibbon and the 19th century German historian Jakob Burckhardt both took a dim view of Eusebius's honesty. Burckhardt called him the first dishonest historian of antiquity. It took the English Byzantine scholar Norman Hepburn Baines, who was a professor at University College London from 1931 to 1942, to show in 1929 that this hypercritical view was wrong. Eusebius was a major biblical scholar, the top biblical scholar in his age. He was all too familiar on a personal level with the effects of persecution of Christians in Palestine and Egypt. How he thought about the place of Christianity in the Roman Empire and the history of the Christian church, which he had seen as a church being persecuted, was changed forever when the unbelievable news came through that one of the rival contenders for the empire might be fighting in the name of Christ. And then Eusebius did what many contemporary historians would do now. Given the circumstances, he tried to keep up with events as they unfolded. It was a moving story. But he was not the unscrupulous journalist that Gibbon and Burckhardt supposed. Eusebius's achievement was to insert the reign of Constantine into the history of Christianity and to present him to posterity as God's representative, the emperor who ended persecution and carried out God's providential plan. He took a long view. Two other works by him from near the end of the reign are also important. These are speeches he wrote for Constantine's 30th anniversary of his reign and for the dedication of the newly built Church of the Holy Sepulchre at Jerusalem, built at Constantine's orders over what were believed to be the actual sites of the crucifixion and the resurrection. Speaking in the presence of the emperor, Eusebius now set out a fully developed theology of empire. As a Christian emperor, Constantine was God's representative on earth, and his empire was God-given, a microcosm of heaven. It was apparently not a problem for Eusebius that Constantine was not yet baptized. And Eusebius was just one of several orators who proclaimed the emperor's praises on his 30th anniversary, a public occasion rather like the Jubilee. And in fact, the only one to put these praises in religious terms and quite probably the only Christian. Even so, he dared to proclaim that God's kingdom had come. God's providence had made the empire uniquely suited to the coming of Christ, and now with the reign of Constantine, to the establishment of Christian rule. It was a momentous claim, and it was a claim that St. Augustine felt went a bit too far, and he revised it, responded to it in his City of God. Eusebius put his last touches to his life of Constantine after the emperor's death, and as he wrote, he was already feeling anxious. He was right. There was no surety that the changes Constantine had put in place would continue. Constantine's three remaining sons became joint emperors together and immediately slaughtered the surviving descendants of Constantius's first marriage, the families of Constantine's half-brothers and half-sisters. Very soon, the sons turned on each other. Nor was there harmony within the church. Constantine's surviving son, the Emperor Constantius II, was anti-Nicene and fought running theological battles with the great Saint Athanasius. It took more than 50 years before the so-called Nicene Creed was officially accepted. Eusebius's optimism was proved to be misplaced. Let me just go backwards a little. Westminster Abbey, burial place of kings and seat of royal ceremonial, is a wonderfully appropriate place in which to say something about Constantine's own death and burial, and to reflect on the competing interests that come into play whenever a ruler or a prime minister dies. In the case of Constantine, this was a moment when conflicting pressures were at their strongest, and even Eusebius couldn't hide it. This is when we see the non-Christian establishment muscling in. Constantine fell ill at Easter in Constantinople, and he was baptized while he was preparing to march east and make war on Persia. This was a man who had his own eldest son and his wife put to death in highly mysterious circumstances. Yet now, Eusebius says, his spiritual qualities had advanced to the peak of human perfection. Constantine probably delayed baptism as long as possible in the hope of dying pure and newly baptized. Eusebius says that from then on, he refused to wear the imperial purple and sat only on a white couch. He fell ill and was baptized in the weeks after Easter and died on the very day of Pentecost, without achieving his hope of being baptized in the River Jordan. The army now took charge. His body was immediately taken with military pomp to Constantinople, and it was the army that came first in paying respects, deciding about the lying in state and sending messengers to inform his son. Rome might have been the expected place for the burial, or rather the funeral pyre and the apotheosis of a Roman emperor. And the Roman senators also tried to make their case heard. But, breaking with tradition, he was buried with Christian rites in Constantinople, in the new mausoleum he'd just built for himself. So the power struggle between the army, the Senate of Rome, and his son Constantius, who was a Christian, was won by his son to that extent. Nevertheless, coins were issued showing him with head veiled like a pagan priest and in a chariot going up to heaven with a divine hand stretched down. This was standard pagan imagery. It was how other emperors had been shown, and the chariot recalled the chariot of the sun god. Even more, as a Roman emperor, coins and inscriptions called him Divus, divine. Eusebius imagines him up in a Christian heaven, but still somehow present to guide his sons on earth. Wishful thinking. But the military and Constantine's much larger number of still pagan subjects still saw him as a traditional Roman emperor. What did Constantine intend? It's hard to know. He only built his mausoleum in Constantinople at the last minute, and it was extraordinary. Apparently, it doesn't survive, a circular building with an altar at which services were held, and with his own sarcophagus in the centre, surrounded by 12 empty sarcophagi or caskets, one each for the 12 apostles. 20 years later, or possibly even in his lifetime, some actual relics were found and deposited there. The arrangement of this mausoleum, where Constantine was buried in the midst symbolically of the apostles, seems like a step far too far. Some scholars argue that he was by then identifying himself with Christ. I don't find that plausible, but it might have seemed logical to some at the time. After all, every Roman emperor before him had become a god. Why not this one? It was quite probably what a lot of people expected, even possibly some new Christians. A contemporary pagan poet scathingly suggested that there were now 12 new gods to pray to. But the arrangement was accepted, and when a later bishop of Constantinople removed Constantine's remains after an earthquake, there was a popular riot. The remains were put back, the bishop was removed. I've made a lot of use of the writings of Eusebius of Caesarea, the bishop, in this lecture. But as we have seen, there were other histories of Constantine that were far less enthusiastic. The problem is that these have been mostly edited out by the Christian tradition. But the voice of opposition can still be heard loudly enough for us to know that it was there. I've been interested in this lecture in two things: the sheer ambiguity of the surviving historical evidence, especially the amount of spin in contemporary writing, and second, in the personal pressures inherent in any position of power. To this, Constantine was no exception. Like the new archbishop, and especially the new pope, he was faced with the issue of how to deal with his predecessors, and indeed his rivals. Unlike them, he solved it by warfare. His wife and his eldest son mysteriously disappeared. He had to play several hands at the same time. Nowhere is this more apparent than in his legislation, which is by no means as Christian as one might expect. He did not make himself the head of the church. He liked to call himself the bishop of those on the outside, which just possibly might be a Constantinian joke. He was surrounded by Christian groups jostling for position, and he made Christianity political, but he did not make the empire officially Christian, and could not when more than 90% of its population, at least, was still pagan. He closed two or three pagan temples, but whatever Eusebius claims, he did not attempt to suppress the rest. He built a new city, Constantinople, modern Istanbul, in which, apart from his own mausoleum, he was more interested in building a palace and a track for chariot racing, adorned with classical statues, than in building churches. My theme has not been about establishment or about the relations between church and state, but about something else that's very much to the fore in our contemporary world, namely the ambiguities of public life and the dangers of believing what we read. In the centuries after Constantine's death, Byzantine writers in the East transferred his vision and his victory to Constantinople. Just 200 or 300 years after his death, it was believed that he'd fought his battle not in Rome, but in Constantinople. In the Latin West, it was claimed that he was baptized by the Bishop of Rome. And in the medieval period, a forged document, the notorious Donation of Constantine, supposedly proved that he'd bestowed the Western Empire on the Bishop of Rome. As for what happened in Constantine's own lifetime, substitute modern newspapers, or better, the media, for Eusebius and the others who wrote about Constantine and projected their own wishes on him, and we might well be in the 21st century. Finally, did Constantine have a vision for the church? I don't think so. Before his day, there were separate churches and separate communities, but arguably no church with a capital C as such. And he himself talked of Christianity as a law, rather like Moses and the law, the tablets of the law. He was surprised and disappointed at the disagreements he found among Christians. It came as a revelation to him that Christians were arguing and quarreling about practice and belief. If there was one thing he wanted, I think, it was agreement between Christians. And he tried to achieve that. He thought it was an easy and a rational explanation. He called councils, he had meetings, he talked to people. But he learned the hard way, and he changed his mind himself. That agreement has still not been achieved. Thank you.